Welcome to the From the Bookshelf podcast. I'm Gary Shapiro. Jennifer Cation Armstrong returns to the show now. She was a longtime contributor to Entertainment Weekly, and her work has appeared in the New York Times Book Review. A few years ago, she wrote a great book about the Mary Tyler Moore Show called Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted and All the Brilliant Minds Who Made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a Classic. Her new book is Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything. Jennifer Cation Armstrong, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
So Seinfeld was a TV show with a wacky cast of characters like, say, Gilligan's Island, and it introduced lots of catchphrases into our vocabulary. It was like laugh in or get smart. So how was it the show that changed everything?
That's what's so interesting about this show. It has a lot of, like you mentioned, the hallmarks of a traditional sitcom, right? Even the general setup, it's in front of a studio audience. You know, they have several different plots going on, et cetera. Hijinks ensue. But they did it, they just sort of like changed it enough that everything after it changes in sitcoms. You know, they introduced, for instance, wacky characters, yes, but also not terribly nice characters, you know. I think that really led us down the path toward what we see now, which is a large number of these anti-hero characters that have become the cool thing. You know, these characters really paved the way for that. They didn't have a lot of redeeming qualities, but we loved them and watching them anyway. They also layered plots more. So instead of having an A and B plot, they had like an A, B, C, and D plot that all came together in a really surprising way at the end. And even over the overall feel of it, you know, they sort of elevated the art, really, of the sitcom. They showed that a sitcom could be smart while still being very funny and, you know, shot things in a way that was a little closer to movie-like or what we now see as single-camera comedies that are all over television. They'd shoot a lot on location, weird camera shots, you know, quick camera movements. So they really kind of elevated the bar for sitcoms that came afterwards.
So you're saying that not just comedies were changed by Seinfeld, but like Walter White is a Seinfeld spinoff?
I think so. And another way that the show was a lot like, you know, I have no other way to describe these things, but the kind of golden age of drama shows that we see now. This had a name brand showrunner. This had Larry David, who created it with Jerry Seinfeld and became famous for creating the show without ever appearing on camera. So famous that he got his own show, Curb Your Enthusiasm, on HBO later. But he was definitely a rare breed at the time, which was a showrunner who people who were really into the show knew his name and understood his contribution.
Well, Carl Reiner was on this program once, and he told us that when he and Mel Brooks recorded The 2,000-Year-Old Man, that they thought no one who wasn't Jewish would find it funny. So was there any similar concern from the creators of Seinfeld?
Oh, yes, famously so. You know, the famous thing is that the NBC executive said they thought that the show was too New York and too Jewish, which to me seems like almost redundant, because usually they just say too New York and they mean too Jewish. But I guess both in this case. And the real concern I think they were voicing there was, you know, is Christian middle America going to get this, or is this just going to be one of those coastal things? And it turned out it transcended all of that. You know, it went far beyond anything they could have imagined. It wasn't just a cult hit. It was definitely a hit among everyone. So it went far beyond that traditional Jewish humor that they were working with. It turns out it's really funny and it's really relatable. So it doesn't really matter what your ethnic background is. People just related to those everyday problems that the Seinfeld characters were dealing with.
Do you think that the makers of television shows, whether it's the networks or whoever makes them, after Seinfeld, had more faith that their audience was not idiots?
I have to think that over time they did. I think that way only because I know in talking to a lot of the writers for Seinfeld that they reported that they were kind of disappointed by the fact that after the show they went out to, you know, get other jobs, create shows for other networks. They all had no problem getting jobs. Everybody got a holding contract, which is where you just think up ideas and they pay you for it. But when they would pitch stuff that was, they felt a lot like Seinfeld, they kind of still kept hearing those same objections yet again, which was, you know, these characters are too unlikable was the biggest thing. This is too weird. They're too unlikable. So I think it took a little while for the lessons to seep in across the board, and they were probably helped a lot by the fragmentation we started to see right afterwards, you know, the move into cable original programming and then streaming original programming. Now we see all kinds of chances being taken that mirror what was going on Seinfeld originally, partly because they sort of invented a lot of this.
But there's also a trend in television and in entertainment in general, which is if something is good, then we should do it and we should flood the market with the exact same thing, a million of them.
Yes, yes. I think, you know, it's funny, I haven't thought a ton about this before, but I think the thing about Seinfeld is there's almost no way to have, you know, you can't just sit down and come up with the next Seinfeld, because the next Seinfeld doesn't look like Seinfeld, if that makes any sense. It's like Seinfeld, the whole point of it was that it was different. It was different from anything we had seen before. So just having, you know, a comedian be your main character and he's going to play an edgy version of himself, which we see a million of, by the way, up till this day.
Right.
Doesn't make it the next Seinfeld. That's not what people didn't go by the millions. Oh my God, I can't wait to watch that show about a stand-up comedian. Because there's nothing I love more than hearing how stand-up comedians live their lives. That wasn't the point. You know, I think that's where, and that's where everything always falls down, right? That imitation thing is that they're never imitating the part of something that made it special. And if you start imitating that too much, it's not special anymore. So finding the next Seinfeld is still something you hear people talk about. And, you know, I don't think it looks like Seinfeld. I think I've made crazy arguments in interviews that perhaps Girls is Seinfeld because it's a comedy of manners and it looks at a certain subset of people and their very specific problems. I think Louie has, you know, hallmarks of the next Seinfeld because he does something so different and has such a clear vision. Even though he does do the thing where he's a, you know, comedian living his life, it's so completely different, and that's what makes it cool.
Well, Girls has in common the fact that you don't like any of the girls.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, in a specific part of New York with kind of like obsessing over little tiny problems that come from having privileged lives, which is very similar to what Seinfeld did, and I think probably Girls gets a lot more flack. We all know why, partly because it's young women and because it's a different time. And in the 90s, like the 90s were a little bit easier time overall. And so I think we were more apt to want to spend time dissecting these little tiny issues of modern life.
I don't know if you saw Seinfeld on Martin Short and Maya Rudolph's show recently.
Yes.
In which Jiminy Glick said something like, can you remind us why America paid you $500 million?
And he's like, I don't know. He probably still doesn't know, you know? It was such a strange thing. And it was part of why I wanted to write a book about it is because it kind of shouldn't have happened. You know, this show got a lot of second and third and fourth chances, you know, in terms of its time with the network and to become the huge hit that it did. And it took its time to find its way. And it is a real phenomenon outside itself once it really took off. I'm sure, you know, I'm sure he's used to it by now, but he's got to sit around sometimes and go, what happened in my life? Like, what is, like, he's brilliant, but, you know, why, like, what a crazy phenomenon that became and kind of continues to be.
I'm sure it's going to happen to us soon. My guest is Jennifer Cation Armstrong, and her new book is called Seinfeldia, how a show about nothing changed everything. In your Mary Tyler Moore book, you were talking, I know you and I talked last time, about how when the show went on the air, when Mary Tyler Moore came on the air in 1969, the networks were, despite their dominance, ultra cautious about putting that show on the air. But with Seinfeld, there was a sense that the network didn't even know the show was on the air.
Yeah, isn't that funny? That really makes all the difference for why it survived. In a weird way, it was good that it was being ignored, but just, you know, ignored just enough, right? So it's like the first episode airs by itself, one episode, in the middle of summer, the day after a national holiday, the day after July 4th, right? So that's not great news for your show. But what happened was that people liked it just enough, particularly Rick Ludwin, one of the network executives who was in charge of late night and specials. He liked it just enough to kind of push for it. And the best he could do was get rid of a Bob Hope special, which was 2 hours, and use that budget and time to make 4 half-hour Seinfelds for the following summer. And again, probably the network executives themselves are not watching their own station at the time. You know, like they're on summer vacation. They're not paying attention.
Who would watch those Bob Hope specials anyway?
I love that little detail simply because it's like, I love the idea that there's somebody who's like, wouldn't even like miss that he didn't have another special. It's like, oh, he won't miss it. It's fine. Bob Hope's cool. you know, he doesn't need another thing to do. So, and what a great little footnote to he contributed to Seinfeld in a way, you know, he contributed to a next generation comedian. And those 4 episodes did just well enough after Cheers reruns to get them a chance at a half season, 13 whole episodes the following year. So it was a really slow build, but I think that that was good because, as you said, they barely, you know, the network barely knew it was on. What that meant is that, you know, Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld could kind of tinker around with the show and figure it out while they were going along. And you can see that in those early episodes.
Yeah, when you talk about the influence of the show, I used to think that every TV show on the air now is Friends. Basically, it's all Friends.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in the book you kind of argue that Friends is Seinfeld.
Well, they felt that way, for sure. Not Friends. The Seinfeld guys really felt that way. There's a hilarious... It's one of my favorite things. I hadn't realized how intense it was. It makes sense. But there's this really intense sibling rivalry between Friends and Seinfeld. They overlap in years, and Friends comes along after that. And the Seinfeld guys really, I've seen recent interviews where they've still said they felt like Friends ripped them off. I think what they mean by that is that before them, there weren't a ton of shows that focused on a group of friends, of unmarried, child-free friends. It was still mostly families or offices, right? So this was a new idea. And then plus they're in New York, right? So I think that's where they felt like they had been ripped off. I think Friends is such a different show that it's sort of a hilarious idea. Like Friends, you know. That's true.
They're slightly less Jewish.
Yeah, they're definitely less Jewish. Well, slightly, you're right. Not definitely. Ross and Monica are for sure Jewish. So, but it goes in such, it takes that one, that idea and goes in such a completely different direction, right? It's like the very famous rule that they had at Seinfeld was no hugging and no learning. I feel like Friends is like 100% hugging and learning. It's also funny, but it's definitely about feeling. And the whole point of Seinfeld is that they stripped the sitcom of all feelings just went for funny. That was it. It was pure. And so I feel like I would actually say most to all sitcoms now are either Friends or Seinfeld. I think they're descendants of one of the two.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Well, when Seinfeld came on the air, it was really kind of the last gasp of network TV dominance. I mean, it was the VCR era, which meant that you could, you know, scan through commercials. But the internet really kind of came into public use during the run of Seinfeld.
Yeah, and it's so funny. Every once in a while, someone shows me a photo online or something of their giant box that they still have of VHS tapes of Seinfeld episodes, which is amazing. I'm like, how do you even watch them now? I don't understand.
But when you after you play your records, you can put your...
Yeah, exactly. You hold it up to the light and just kind of look at it that way. But that was part of it. And you know, I think that that actually did contribute to the way that people watch Seinfeld, that geeky kind of way that people started to obsess over the show, which I think is yet another sign of things to come. Like, I think that shows the beginning of how we watch television now, the way we like to analyze every episode, quote everything, memorize everything, talk about it online incessantly, all of that stuff. It starts with being able to record things, because if you can't even watch it one more time, it's really hard to obsess too much, right? It goes by, it's over. This way, it was like people, there are people who were completists and recorded every episode. Somebody did just tell me the other day that not only did he record every episode, he sat and did it so that there were no commercials. To me, that's where we go from Seinfeld to Seinfeldia, if you will. I mean, the point of my title of my book is that I kind of invented this word for a dimension between reality and fiction where Seinfeld continues on and on, right? So that's where you're living if you still are watching your tapes that you made in the 90s meticulously without commercials, or hopefully have moved on to DVDs, which are a little easier to handle. There are whole swaths of the internet devoted to obsessing over Seinfeld. There's a virtual reality deal, I don't know what you call that thing, you know, program where you shows you how tech savvy I am. Where you can put on the headset and you can visit Jerry's apartment. This guy meticulously recreated Jerry's apartment so you could walk through it in virtual reality. There are Twitter feeds that are dedicated to imagining what it would be like if Seinfeld were still on the air. There's just this endless amount of stuff. There's Seinfeld emojis. So there's a lot that shows, it almost feels like it never went off the air. And it's really a show that was made for now, you know, for the way we watch TV now, not the way we used to watch TV.
Well, isn't there, didn't you say something in your book about there's like competing Twitter feeds about what Seinfeld would be like now?
Yes. I actually was completely obsessed with this situation to the point where it's possible I could write an entire book just about the Seinfeld Twitter feeds.
Well, Jennifer Cation Armstrong, your first book about the Mary Tyler Moore Show, oh, that wasn't your first book, but your last book, rather, I should say. That book was kind of history for you. I mean, that, you know, not for me, but for you.
Yes.
But this book, not so much. I mean, you were a Seinfeld viewer. So how was it different writing these two books?
I want to say in some ways it was easier because, you know, I lived it. That's the first part. So I actually remembered things that had happened. It wasn't like I had to go back and be like, was the finale a big deal? Oh, look, it was. Like, I was there. It was a big deal. I remember it. I remember a lot of my favorite episodes. I remember my feelings growing up with it. There's also a lot more media. So this is like a side note in some ways, but it's more about the progression of time and how TV is covered. But there was so much more coverage of every little thing that was going on with Seinfeld versus something in the 70s. A show that was just as big, Mary Tyler Moore Show, but we didn't have the obsessive coverage. We didn't take it as seriously. So it wasn't like there were tons and tons and tons of profiles and articles and on-the-set reporting and all these things that were available for Seinfeld. And even the internet came in before the end of Seinfeld. So I got very into exploring the early message boards for Seinfeld. So you could see people's reactions, you know, in real time. So I'm really interested to see how it gets different as we move forward. It's going to be so much easier to write books about shows on in the internet time because you'll know what everybody felt at every moment. On the other hand, that also was a challenge because it became about, is there anything I could possibly say about this thing that hasn't been covered to death? So there's a plus and a minus to that.
I remember the finale to Mary Tyler Moore Show pretty well. And actually, it was a big deal because finales were kind of a big deal. When the first finale ever was the finale to The Fugitive in 1967, that finale kind of killed the show in syndication. So I think networks after that didn't want to have finales because then people wouldn't watch the show in syndication anymore. And they sort of stuck to that until I think MASH was the first kind of modern show to have a finale.
And then they kind of went out of favor again, really. I feel like it's something that really shows get when there's such a big deal and they're going off the air when they're still a big deal. So people care, right? Whereas if you're one of those shows that just sort of fades, you know, like goes down in the ratings until you're kicked off the air, no one cares by that time.
The last episode of whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, no one cares. No one's like, remember the last episode of Facts of Life? That was a good one, right? Like, I watched that thing. I have no idea what happened in the last episode.
They all went off a cliff in a bus.
That's the thing, is that you didn't have these statement finales, essentially. The Mary Tyler Moore Show is probably one of the gold standards, and so is MASH. But most shows didn't go off the air of their own volition the way that the Mary Tyler Moore Show did. And in the, you know, decades between that and Seinfeld, most shows faded and didn't. And, you know, the 80s were not exactly a golden age of quality television to a large extent. There were good things, but most of it is Facts of Life and Silver Spoons and stuff like that. Whereas Seinfeld comes back and it's like massive hype. Right? Because they're going off, you know, here's a guy who turned down $5 million an episode to continue. So people were still interested. And to an extreme degree. And there's all this media coverage now. So it was this just insanity. I mean, I remember the insanity. And then when I went back into the research, it was like even more insane than I had realized at the time.
The vehement reactions to it were crazy.
Yes. And I think, I mean, I could be wrong, but aside from, well, did people like the Fugitive finale? I can't really remember.
Oh, yeah, no, they loved it. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, so, and they loved the Mary Tyler Moore Show finale. They loved the Newhart finale. You know, so those really great ones along the way. And this is where we start to get into this, people trying to do something with their finale. And, God, you know, people really were very upset.
Yeah. Well, because of the hype. I guess because of the hype, you know.
That's completely how I see it.
You know, the good ones like Mary Tyler Moore and Newhart, those were just regular length episodes. I mean, the MASH episode was like 2.5 hours. But the Seinfeld finale was at least twice as long, right? Or it was a little bit longer.
For sure. I think it was a little longer than an hour, actually. It's pretty long. I know that. And it feels weird, and I get that. It feels different. They're out of their main element. They're out of, you know, their traditional set. And, you know, I get all of that, and I do understand why people didn't like it. I think they felt like it was a little bit of a middle finger from Larry David, right? Like, ha-ha, you've been watching these terrible people all this time, and I tricked you into it. It was kind of, you know, I think that's sort of how it came off. And plus the hype. It's like you're sitting there with, like, 25 of your friends thinking, I don't know what you think is going to happen, but it wasn't that. You know, but when I watch it now, I actually really love it. I think it's a hilarious statement. I think I love that it is a statement that he tried to do something. You know, I like all of that. And that was stuff that other shows had not attempted before. But you're Seinfeld. You got to try something different.
Well, you did a marvelous job of capturing it all in Seinfeldia. That's the name of the book. Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything. And the author, my guest, Jennifer Cation Armstrong, thanks so much for visiting with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. I want to thank my guest, Jennifer Cation Armstrong, her new book, Seinfeldia. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.